This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode of New Books in Islamic Studies, which is part of the New Books Network. My name is Shobana Xavier, and I hope you're safe and well wherever you are. And thank you so much for joining us today. In their edited volume, Veil Obsessed, Representations in Literature, Art, and Media, published by Syracuse University Press, Umay Al-Wazidi, who's a professor of postcolonial literatures in the Department of English at Augusta College, and Afreen Zanat, who's a professor of English at Dallas College in Dallas, Texas, put forth a volume that complicates discussions of the veil and highlight the prevalent anxieties surrounding it. The edited volume is unique in its focus and engagement of the veil as it appears in various literary, artistic, and popular cultures, such as of historical Algeria, Iranian television shows, Bollywood films, and street art in Europe. The book locates these critical discussions and scholarly interventions within both a post-colonial and neo-colonial critique of how the veil was orientalized and fetishized historically, for example, in the Victorian transmissions of the 1001 Nights, and how the veil, specifically the burqa, is deployed in reductive and harmful ways in contemporary state projects today, such as in France or even in popular Loblaw discourses, such as they take place in the United States. The essays in this collection are sharp and accessibly written and will be useful in various undergraduate courses. The book will also be of interest to those who work on literature, popular culture, gender, Islam, and much more. In our conversation today, we spoke about some of the interventions that Umay and Afreen make with this volume, the use of Frantz Fanon and his critique of imperialism and colonialism to approaching some of the case studies, such as of the Algerian example, Mani Ratnam, Bollywood director, and his film Bombay, and the anxieties prevailing this film, particularly around the veil, which is Afreen's chapter in this edited volume, and much, much more. So, without further delay, here's my conversation with Umay Al-Wazidi and Afreen Zanat about their edited volume, Veil Obsessed, Representations in Literature, Art, and Media.
Hi, Umay and Afreen. Thank you so much for joining us on the New Books in Islamic Studies podcast. I'm really excited to talk to you. How are you both doing? Afreen, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for hosting us and choosing our book for your podcast.
Of course, I'm excited. So what we do on the podcast a little bit is to talk about you as authors and editors in this case and your intellectual journey. So Umay, maybe we could start with you to tell us a little bit about who you are and what led to this project, and then we'll go to Afreen.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for having us in your podcast. It's wonderful to talk about this book. I think, and Afrin will share this with you too, because both Afrin and I have grown up in Bangladesh and we studied in the university. So my master's is from Rajshahi University, Bangladesh. It's a very small town in Bangladesh. And then I moved to the US to do master's at Eastern Illinois University and at Purdue University. And my focus has been, I've been working on Salman Rushdie, Taslima Nasreen, and as you know, both of them are very controversial about the identity of Muslim women and also the different representation of veil in Rushdie and Nasreen. And I think that's how actually, you know, we've been focusing on this idea of the veil, you know, particularly for me because of my research and interest in those two areas.
Afrin?
Yes. So I grew up in India and went to a Christian Catholic school. We had nuns in our school who would veil. And then while I was young, for a brief moment, we spent some time in Saudi Arabia. My dad was posted there, got a job there. So I traveled to Saudi Arabia and then came back to India, completed my bachelor's from Aligarh Muslim University. After marriage, I went to Bangladesh and did my master's in English literature from Dhaka University. And then I came to America on a junior Fulbright scholarship to pursue a second master's degree. My master's thesis was on Jonathan Swift, 18th century English literature. Went on to pursue my PhD. My PhD focus was 19th century American literature. So I did not, unlike Umia Dr. Al-Wazidi, I did not have that kind of a background looking at veiling. But I've always been very observant of the fact that people were veiling at a certain point in my life. And then I was noticing the changes that were happening around me in terms of, you know, society in India and in Bangladesh, how gradually I noticed people taking on the veil as opposed to, you know, the ghoonghat that I saw when I was younger. So I was observing these things and I was noticing a change. And Dr. Wazidi and we met in 2013 for an MLA conference. And we started chatting, we started talking about what's going on back home. Mm-hmm. So we were talking about how young women were taking the hijab and why this was happening and all that. And that's where we got our idea for a special panel for MLA. And so we started working on it and we had that panel next year in 2014, MLA, and the turnout was huge. It was like the whole room was full of people. There were people waiting to get in, the people sitting on the floor because they seemed to be very interested on this topic. And so we thought maybe there is some scope to develop this into a book or something. That's when our journey actually started.
Yeah. And we were really interested with Syracuse University Press because they had special area topics and subjects on Muslim women and veil. And I think that was the first place we submitted Syracuse University Press, and we stayed with them. And I wanted to give a little bit of a shout out to Carol Father Conray, who I had met at Purdue University, who worked on Asia Dejavar and Middle Eastern women's writing. And I kind of talked about it with her and she gave me some suggestions. So yeah, absolutely. And then after that, we just went off.
It's great to hear and just kind of the interest in it. And I think one of the things about this volume that is very focused is also the literary, artistic, and media component, as well as that it's covering varied kind of a global context, picking up on South Asia, Algeria, France, particularly in different sections, but it's all really linked and focused together in terms of media representations in a really broad and capacious way. So it's both broad and also focused, which is really lovely with the contributors you have together. So what would you say maybe are the broader interventions before we get into some of the sections and organization of the articles that are organized? What would you say in terms of the takeaway? Because the veil is a topic that is quite discussed and a lot of people talk about it in very interdisciplinary ways. And so what would you hope that people who pick up this book, Veiled Obsessed, and even with the title, you're kind of hinting at it. What are perhaps interventions you're trying to make? Ume, perhaps we could start with you.
Yeah, I think Afrin and I were just discussing the other day what was the larger intervention here. I think for me, it was colonization. I mean, if you look at all of our chapters, we begin with the representation or the translation of the Arabian Nights, right? And I have, you know, heard about, or my grandmother told me stories from the Arabian Nights, and our kids in the US also hear stories from there. But the way those translations are made, you can see the reference of the European gaze on the veil, you know, that veiled women are cheeky, mysterious, you know, or suspicious and all of those things. And then we move on to Algeria and French colonization. So I think I'm going to say it's colonization. And I think the newer generation of researchers and writers, Muslim and non-Muslim women and men, need to think about the aftermath of colonization and how it can not only destroy a civilization, but create these stereotypes. So to be aware of neo-colonization or whatever that is happening somewhere else, I mean, they need to be aware of that. Yeah, and I think that is the large kind of focus. You know, you say the broad area, I think that would be the one that I would want to emphasize on.
Afrin?
So for me, I started my understanding of the veil or the hijab becoming so prominent in our society, in South Asia particularly. And we were focused on South Asia when we started, because we were seeing people, young girls, middle-aged women, taking on the hijab, which was not a practice in South Asia. So I was really wondering what is going on. And it began with me not knowing what was happening and a desire to find out why they were doing it. And so this was my journey, understanding the whole idea the practice of veiling, how it was shifting, how it was changing from how it was practiced earlier by our grandmothers, mothers, and how, you know, the modern form of hijab that was kind of becoming very prevalent in society. So it was my journey understanding why these women were taking up the hijab. I just want to share this experience. Recently, I was talking to a few of my colleagues and telling them about this book that is forthcoming. And my American colleagues were surprised that hijab is anything else other than patriarchal imposition on women. So they were surprised that they were surprised when I told them that there are many young women who are taking the hijab on their own. There's no pressure from fathers or male members of the family or female members for that matter, that they come from families where mothers are not wearing the hijab, but young girls are taking it up. And that this is more for the Muslim diaspora in America, or second generation Muslim children who are born in America, it's more a question of identity and not patriarchal imposition, as many people are kind of thinking of it as. So I thought, you know, that was interesting, that this book can aim to change people's views of what hijab, taking the hijab in, entails.
And the volume really gives nuanced and textured and layered approaches to these conversations, from colonization to different geographical contexts to media. And part one, as you're hinting to Ume, which is titled Beyond Orientalism and Colonialism, The Lasting Influence of the Colonial Gaze, you both have kind of the 1001 Nights, which Michael James Lundell does a really excellent job, like highlighting the translation process and also kind of the reception process and what these stories meant in the orientalized imagination of Muslim bodies. And it shifts then, I think the other two chapters is a really great focus on Algeria. And what I really appreciated was the focus on Frantz Fanon, like a Fanonian kind of theoretical intervention that the authors are using. So why is, for perhaps some of our listeners who don't know, why is the Algerian example, and especially in terms of colonialism, Orientalism, but also women's, Algerian Muslim women's resistance, and perhaps an important way to start this conversation.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Yeah, absolutely. I think because for me, when I started reading about the veil and colonization, of course, I think Algeria was central for me because of French colonization. You know, sometimes we compare Belgium colonization, the British colonization, the French colonization, Portuguese colonization. And, you know, some people think, okay, no colonization is ever better, but some colonizations are really, really drastic. I mean, not only eliminating the civilization and languages, but also the identity that continues. So in this case, French colonization of Algeria, I think, has been a deep-rooted sort of fear in me has created. Because if you remember, there's a chapter by Professor Antel and Professor Amer. They're talking about right now what is happening in France, right? So France is not colonizing anybody right now, but what they're doing in France is a sort of a neo-colonization where they're saying that, well, no, you cannot wear the hijab in the public spaces. You cannot wear the hijab in the school system. So again, it is affecting the newer generation, as Afrin pointed out, a little bit more children who are born in France, either their parents having Algerian background or a Bangladeshi background or Indian background or Pakistani background. These children are almost going through the similar situation as perhaps, you know, has gone on in Algeria through French colonization. So I think that was our reason to have, you know, this focus on Algeria. And I wish somebody had submitted a chapter on Asia Dejavert's Fantasia. It's a beautiful novel, but it is a very deep, like it has so many layers, but it is a beautiful one to think about too, if anybody wants to further their research on the case of Algeria.
Yeah, I can talk about my chapter and Cherry's chapter on Iran, how veiling is considered to be us, how in Iran veiling is part of the political ideology, and how Iranian society views veiling in terms of women's piety. So I thought that chapter was especially important in light of the fact that, you know, we have these protests in Iran since last year. So I can briefly talk about my chapter first, and then I'll talk about Cherry's chapter. So the movie Bombay that I'm referring to in my book was released when I was young, when I was a young girl, a young Muslim girl in India. And there was a lot of commotion around the movie. Muslim families did not want their daughters to see the movie. And I was curious what's going on. I mean, we did see the trailer and things like that, but I wanted to watch the movie. So I went ahead and I watched the movie in spite of my parents telling me not to watch the movie. And it stayed with me. And so that idea of what Mani Ratnam was doing in the movie, it took me quite a while to kind of, you know, come to terms with what was going on in the movie. But later when I read Hussein's Sultana's Dream, she comes from the same city as me. So her school, Sakhawat girls' school is also in the same city. And so I used to pass the school all the time, but I did not know about her literary work. Much later in my life, when I read her work, I realized what she was trying to do. She was trying to empower Muslim women, give them more agency so that they can go for higher education and basically achieve whatever dreams they had. And then when I compared it to what Maniratnam is doing, I realized that Maniratnam is not trying to empower Muslim women by unveiling the main character, Shaila Banu. What Maniratnam was trying to do was mostly use her unveiling to make her, subjugate her under Hindu patriarchal family. So I thought that was problematic. And I realized that maybe Maniratnam should have used the whole idea of unveiling her to kind of give her more agency and pursue maybe her dreams and do things as so many Muslim women in India and the rest of the world are doing, you know. So they are wearing a hijab or the veil, and they are kind of fulfilling their dreams, their wishes, aspirations, becoming scientists, doctors, and whatnot. But I felt like Maniratnam does not aim to do that. His only goal is to kind of make Shaila Banu part of like the larger majoritarian Hindu society. So that I thought was problematic, and that is what kind of forced me to kind of look at both these works and compare them. Now, Cherry's chapter I thought was really interesting because of the recent protests in Iran with Mahsa Amini and all the other women trying to unveil and not kind of allow the Iranian government to force them to veil. What she discusses in her chapter is basically the different forms of veiling in Iran and how these different forms correspond to how society sees these women in terms of their piety, religious piety and things like that. So I found that really interesting. It was I did not know about these different kinds of veilings. I think her chapter sheds light into that. And it was particularly interesting because I consume a lot of global culture. So I watch a lot of TV shows and TV shows from across the world. So I watch Bangladeshi TV programs, TV shows or dramas. I see Pakistani TV shows and dramas. I watch Turkish TV shows and dramas. And I don't see veiling that prevalent in these TV shows. Maybe in society in these countries, veiling is more, happening at a larger rate, but in these TV shows, there is like, I would say hardly a depiction of female characters veiling. And so I was like, you know, I thought it is important that Cherry kind of sheds light into this area, and we get to see how pop culture in Iran shapes or influences people into taking and helps the political ideology, the power in Iran to kind of, you know, enforce it on women in Iran. So that chapter for me was the most important in terms of what's going on in the world right now.
And if I could add a little bit, because Afrin and I were discussing again about the Bangladeshi drama, the serials that we get to see. So in our introduction, if you remember, we wrote that there has been the increase of wearing the veil, like the burqa, like top to bottom in the public spaces, more than we had seen when, at least I had seen when I was a girl growing up there. And we were thinking that the TV series and the dramas, we don't see women veiling. I mean, one of the reasons is because, of course, Bangladesh is not a republic, Islamic republic. I mean, it's the democratic government of Bangladesh, unlike Iran. But again, the media is completely different, yeah, from what you see in the public space. So I think this was a question for us that we needed to ask. And Donika's chapter kind of does that as well, like question some of these things like the street art versus what you get to see in TV.
No, I mean, I loved one of the things about Cherry's chapter that I also found fascinating in her analysis, in their analysis of the Iranian TV series, was kind of also censorship, you know, in terms of what was not on screen, but was presumed to have happened in terms of social life or gender interactions or certain kind of parties. And that was really, really fascinating. And that's kind of tying into what is just presumed to happen that everybody brings as kind of viewers, and then what is actually projected onto the screen. And of course, I think, you know, I also grew up watching, you know, Maniratnam's Bombay was a huge film. The soundtrack was a huge, you know, Huma Huma is still in my head when I was reading the chapter. And I think in Bollywood, we just don't often, one, talk about perhaps the blatant Islamophobia that's in it. But then second, kind of the nuances of it, like the gendered Islamophobia or kind of the gendered violence that happens. And so reading and, you know, thinking about Maniratnam's work as an example, kind of a series of other Bollywood films and the work that they're doing in kind of a state way was also really, really fascinating. And thinking them kind of in relationship to each other as like, what are the differences? What are the similarities? And I really, again, really, really enjoyed it. I think this pop culture is such an important kind of site of analysis, and I value that in terms of the work some of the authors are doing here as well. Do you think about that? I mean, it sounds like you think about it a lot, but perhaps for listeners who don't think about pop culture or mass media or media broadly, why do you think this is kind of an important site of analysis? Because I know we often will say, well, we think of Islam or Muslim women, and you think, okay, we have to go to the Quran or we have to go to jurisprudential traditions. And these are all things that some of the contributors cite as kind of historical conversations of Islamic feminism or responses to it. But why are these other productions also important?
So I think young generation, they consume more pop culture than maybe our generation. And I think pop culture is all around. People are watching things, and these are, I would say, avenues where, you know, these stereotypes of Muslims can be in subtle ways, you know, injected into the viewers. And I think that is why it's important to kind of look at pop culture, what's going on with pop culture across the world. Because our young generation, they consume it much more than maybe us and older generations. So it's important to kind of look to the future and talk about pop culture in order to educate future generations and to maybe make them a little aware of how of not, you know, falling for those stereotypical views of groups of people all over the world.
Yeah, and I think when it comes to America, of course, you use the word and that which we also focus on is Islamophobia, right? I mean, particularly the films, the dramas, the series, and the issues of representation and right kind of representation. Now, if you think about, you know, some of the popular series in America, like Law and Order, CSI, Los Angeles, you know, these kind of series that people are interested in, or young generation people, like my daughter, you know, is interested. I remember, I think there was one series in Law and Order where they were talking about honor killing, I think, and the way that is represented. I think the American TV serial, they're trying to have good representation of the hijabi woman. But I think that still, if you look at larger films, you know, it's still those kind of stereotypings that we have seen existing for a long period of time. Yeah. Yeah. So that's why it's, I think it becomes important, because our kids are always on the phone and it's always like some reel or the other, you know, that's there watching. I hope they'll read too.
Yeah. Getting them to read. Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a challenge that most of us have. And I think pop culture is definitely an interesting way to, they consume so much. So how can we interject, as you say, and say, well, let's be conscientious consumers and let's interrupt some of the images that are being flashed before you that you're just kind of absorbing without really pausing. And I teach a class on religion and pop culture, and it's often kind of the conversations that we try to have with the students and say, this is also a site where you need to analyze and not just receive passively, right? Yeah,
but I should also do justice, you know, while I'm criticizing the media or the U.S. This industry and the pop culture industry, like Miss Marvel, like Kamala Khan. I mean, that is wonderful. Yeah. You know, that is really wonderful in that book, in that series, where she struggles with these, some of the rules that our mothers have told us too about what kind of dressing we need to do. But then what about superheroes? I mean, if Afrin and I, we have time in the future, maybe we'll do another book on this one, because I love, you know, Superman, Spider-Man, and I think Miss Marvel asked the crucial question, like, where am I in this scenery? Right. So, yeah.
That's fabulous. Yeah. And it'll be definitely interesting to see to what kind of response that comes up from it. The final section, part five, which, as you say, you started in the first section and dealing with kind of colonial Algeria, the final section kind of pivots back into kind of present day France. And there's a lot of issues going on in Europe in terms of the veiling, the banning of veiling. And Sahir Mir and Martine Antel's chapter is fabulous. And also Joseph L. Duncan's, in terms of the veil and this issue of belonging and citizenship, especially from a state perspective, and what the banning of veiling means, and particularly the burqa, like the full covering. And I think it might be in Amir and Antil's chapter where they say that the proportionate number of people who actually use the burqa in France is very, very minimal. Like, the statistics on this was wild, because I had never thought about this, versus the policy that is geared towards actually any kind of religious symbolism in kind of public spaces. So perhaps, I know there's been a lot written about this topic. People are writing a lot about France and kind of, again, growing forms of anti-Muslim policies. But did you want to talk a little bit about what this final section is doing, and also how this section is trying to pivot towards, as it says, a new discourse? Like, where do we go towards in terms of the future? Afrin, perhaps you could start.
Yeah, I think it was a conscious decision to kind of start the book with the section on Algeria, 1001 Nights, and end with Martin Antel's and Sahar Amir's chapter, because we feel like it's like, you know, bringing the topic to a close sense, I mean, giving it a sense of closure. So looking at the past and then bringing it forward to the present, and maybe posing these questions to readers that they should continue this discourse, and that this should be that we should continue to analyze this as, you know, things happen. For example, when this paper, when the chapter by Sherry was written, it was written in 2015-16, but it's still so relevant today. And likewise, I think Antil and Amir's chapter, I'm sure in future too, it's going to be very relevant. So it kind of gives us this contextual knowledge of what is going on in France. And then we can use that to kind of explore how things are changing politically or socially in different parts of the world. I think this chapter can be, I mean, a lot of the ideas they discuss in the chapter can be applied to basically any country. I don't know if you know what's going on in India right now. This hijab discourse just started 2 years back in India. There were in Bengaluru, there were girls, Muslim girls, were not allowed to enter a college campus because they were wearing a hijab. So I think it continues across geographical regions, and some of the ideas that they explore in that chapter are still relevant even in India. I mean, the statistics of, you know, women actually, how many women actually wear, as opposed to maybe what is shown in media in India. I'm talking specifically about India. They are very different. So I think that chapter, we specifically chose that chapter because it kind of encapsulates a lot of the anxieties people have across the world, across cultures, about Muslim women wearing hijab. So I think that is important. And it doesn't end there. You know, we can take some of these ideas and continue to apply them to different parts of the world.
Yeah, and I think for Donica's chapter, you know, it was about I think why we ended with his chapter was because he was taking us to the streets, right? Because we have to remember that what percentage of women are in academia, in these higher institutions where we teach these chapters or any chapters from any other books that focus on veil. So, I mean, what are groups of people doing to break the stereotypical idea or that veil is the sign of oppression in the streets? So then, you know, the street arts, he brings in the street arts. And if you remember in our introduction, we talk about the fashion industry too, because there has been a lot of women sort of correcting the fashion industry in terms of letting people know that, you know, veil is part of identity. We believe in it because we believe, you know, there are some prescriptions of how we might wear it instead of it just being something that is weird or, you know, someone else who's not a Muslim wearing it and walking the fashion, sort of what you call it, like doing the catwalk. So I think that was important for us to remember about Donika's chapter. And particularly myself, and Afrin can chime in too, because I don't wear veil. But as a Muslim woman, and the issue about citizenship is really important for me to think about all the time, because is my religion, because I'm Muslim, am I considered lesser citizen than someone else, right? And I think Donika kind of tried to hit that point that the women who wear hijab, are they lesser citizen than you know, the other women or not? That was important for us to think about as well. And I think one of the issues, not issues, I think one of the things that Afrin and I try to set, not necessarily correct, but we try to talk about it, that we are pious Muslims, even though we are not wearing veil, and that could be an identity, that could be our identity. So isolation could be an issue with newer generation of kids who do not veil, but they're also Muslim. And I think that is one direction that I think the last chapters should ask people to think about, because there could be an anxiety there among young women or children who do not veil, and the way the things are going politically forward, I mean, there might be an anxiety, and they need to be confirmed that no, it's not about wearing the veil all the time. It doesn't have to be part of your identity if you are Muslim.
And I think the title really captures the sense that it is like veiled obsessions. You're like, you know, looking at all of these anxieties around it, and they're all quite similar and dissimilar and dissonant and, you know, aligned. And it's not at all, you know, one story doesn't fit all, one veil does or does not fit all kind of model. Yeah. And I think Donika's chapter really, by taking it to the street, like the street art and the embodiment, is like fabulous ending too, right? Because they look at different case studies, you know, Nakabit or Princess Ajab or Banksy and all of these kind of PH different folks who are doing subversive things on street and in kind of on walls, which is a really fascinating way to think about some of these interventions and interruptions and what people are doing on YouTube, right? So going from kind of the Algerian, you know, postcards that were problematic and a Muslim woman being unveiled very problematically, to kind of ending off on somebody who is playing with the niqab. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was Nakabit or where they veiled at the top half and then wore short and stilettos at the bottom and are walking around and filming this, trying to interrupt and Parisian space or French space or whatever. Mm-hmm. These are kind of really the broad spectrum of ways to have some of these conversations. And I just thought that kind of this focus on street art I haven't seen before, and I really enjoyed it and loved it, this chapter. Yeah.
And then you talk about postcard, like, and they see how it matches the Algerian postcard. And then in our introduction, and Donika also mentions about the Women's March, where that portrait of that Bangladeshi girl was circulated with the hijab being in the flag. And I think when I saw the picture, I was very anxious. I mean, people were like, were very happy and they were like celebrating this image, but it made me very anxious because again, when it comes to citizenship, you know, wearing it is a as a type of a hijab, I wondered if we would make ourselves vulnerable, more vulnerable in terms of what Greater America sees the Muslims, right? And I don't want to necessarily be very political here, but, you know, the relationship of the Middle Eastern countries and America. I mean, I was very anxious at that time. I don't think it helped me seeing that image. So, I mean, we tried to talk a little bit about that, the controversy of that postcard. But when Afrin and I were looking at the proofreading of proofs of the book, we were like, oh my God. I mean, it starts with that, you know, the postcards, and we end with this postcard. But we're still left with all of the anxieties, and we have more questions to go forward.
Which is the success of a book ultimately, I think, you know, kind of the artistic and literary and media focused case studies really makes this book unique and innovative in that way. And I really, really appreciated reading it. I've been hearing from both of you that if there were a second edition to this, you already have some ideas in the wings, maybe. What are perhaps some case studies for various reasons that weren't included in this edited volume that you imagine in a second? And one, if there were to be, perhaps would be examples or case studies. And perhaps maybe people who are listening might also be curious to pick those kind of research questions up themselves. Afrin, do you have some thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there were so many different cultures that were not included. I would want to kind of include voices from Malaysia, Indonesia, one of the most populous Muslim countries in the world. I think that would be really interesting. We wanted to hear more from Africa, maybe. Algeria, yes, but maybe other countries, how it's kind of practiced in other parts of the world. Because when I was in Saudi Arabia, there were in the 80s, there were quite a few Somalian immigrants in Saudi Arabia. So they used to do veiling, and they always intrigued me. So I feel like there's so much. There are so many different cultures where veiling is practiced, and we were not able to include them. I think including diverse voices would maybe make that second edition or volume so much more richer.
Yeah, and definitely, I think along that line, Afghanistan would be one of the other places, because sometimes we get to see these pictures and postcards like students going to university, like wearing skirts and pants and tops. That would be an amazing kind of a profile to follow up on. Other than those two, I think we need to focus on newer generation, like belonging and identity in a large universe, but very small, because we are connected through media and we know everything that is going on everywhere right now. So I think setting some of those stories, stereotypes correct for the newer generation is really important to focus on. Yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking maybe some writers from Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
there's so many cultures where it's such an important part of their existence, and we were not able to kind of cover those cultures. I think that would be really great.
Yeah,
I mean, I think one of the great things about the volume is that as you're reading through case studies, you could really kind of internally think through how this applies to different situations.
Yeah, it does.
I was doing that with the context in Quebec, because I live in Canada, and in Quebec there has similar kind of French legacies in terms of veiling and similar bannings. And on the other end, being Sri Lankan, I was also thinking about what's happening to Muslims in Sri Lanka, and very similar conversations around the abaya and kind of state. But in this context, like a Buddhist majoritarian state kind of mapping and controlling Muslim minority communities as well. So there's ways in which I think the reader can also reflect on their own locales or cultural locations as they're reading these case studies, because they're written in really really accessible in wonderful ways. I know there's a lot of things that we didn't get to. Is there perhaps anything that we didn't get a chance to talk about that you want to highlight?
Yeah, I think if people are interested, I was thinking about Nishat Haider's chapter. I think her chapter is also on film. I mean, if people are interested to look at the theoretical development of the, you know, the Muslim woman's sort of trajectory or movements from one era to another one, I think that's a really wonderful paper, because you know, I'm a fan of Pakiza and that film. It's, oh my God, it's so beautiful. And then, you know, the how the veil is used in that film itself, and how it moves on to Maniratram's Bombay. I think that was wonderful to think about. And then the other chapters, for example, there's a chapter on Maghribi woman. It's a short chapter, but beautifully presented about how the generation of veiling has happened, right? So I think those are wonderful chapters as well. There's chapters on fiction, so that is also the highlight of this volume as well.
Fabulous. Well, I know the book is not even out, and I got an advanced copy, so this is a weird question to be asking, but hopefully when the book is officially out, you get to celebrate it, because it is wonderful and an important work, and so thank you for that. But are there things that either of you are doing independently in terms of future scholarships or perhaps future collaborations? Afreen, what are you up to these days? When's this project officially done?
I'm really interested in Bollywood. And because I watch a lot of Bollywood movies, and I'm trying to kind of work on Bollywood movies, South Asian literature. My specialization is 19th century American literature. So I'm currently working on turning my dissertation into a book. So it looks at orphan narratives in 19th century American fiction, postbellum American fiction. So that is something that's in the pipeline. Another, like I said, Bollywood is always something that interests me. So I'm working on, we are both actually working on a collection of essays on Guru Dutt and his movies. And it's commissioned by Edinburgh University Press. Next year, 2025, is his centenary celebration. So he's going to be 100 years old. So we are hoping to bring it out before the celebrations start. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I am currently working on bringing out a special edition on Bangladeshi literature for South Asian Review, the journal South Asian Review. So there is going to be one special issue on Bangladeshi literature that's coming out. And the second thing that I'm working on, it is going to be my monograph is. I'm working on Muslim representations in dystopic fiction. Very weirded out by the way the Muslims are represented in a dystopia. I'm continuing kind of to working on with the issues about veil and Muslim women and in US and Euro-American countries. And yeah.
Oh, both sound so fabulous. I look forward to kind of following your trails and seeing what you're up to and the important work you're doing. I'm really grateful that we got to connect, and I'm really grateful that I got to learn more about your scholarships and kind of the important work you're doing. And I really hope our listeners will pick this up. When does it officially come out? I know we're recording this conversation and it's end of mid-March, I guess, but it should be out soon, I would imagine. Yeah.
I think it's between April 15th and 1st May.
Okay.
As far as I remember, yeah.
So if they listen to it right away, the book may not be out, but they definitely should put an order in it. So congratulations again for this wonderful work, and thank you so much for connecting with me.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, of course.
Thank you so much.
And that was my conversation with Ume Al-Wazidi and Afreen Sanat about their new edited volume, Veil Obsessed, Representations in Literature, Art, and Media. I hope you enjoyed the conversation, and I hope you'll join me again next time. Until then, take good care.